You're listening to Old New Borrowed Blue on 2SER with your host, Joel Kassam.
Hello and welcome to Old New Borrowed Blue on 2SER 107.3. Joel Kassam is my name. I hope you're doing very well and thank you for joining me this week. If you're new to the show, this is where I invite a special guest into the studio and they take the musical reins by playing four of their favourite songs. All right, let's find out who we've got this week. It's not every day you can say you've had a sporting career that spanned 18 years at the top, including four National League titles, three World Championships, and two Commonwealth Games gold medals. However, my next guest can. Currently jumping around the country with the release of her new book, If At First You Don't Conceive, brilliant name by the way, I'm so excited to say I'm joined by former Australian netball captain and sporting legend, Liz Ellis. Welcome to the show, Liz.
Joel, lovely to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for coming in. Now, did you grow up in a really sporting family?
Sporting-ish, yeah. My dad was a stock car driver. He was the Australian stock car champion for a couple of years, won a number of titles at the old Sydney Showground.
Right.
His nickname was Wrecker. And okay. The people who he used to race with told me they thought I played netball like he drove cars. You'd imagine what it was like. And my mum was a netball player. She was quite a handy netball player, just played local reps.
Okay.
So there was always sort of some sort of sport around our family. We watched a lot of sport on television and played it.
So it was kind of in the blood. So did you follow then in your mum's footsteps if she was the netball player?
Yes, I did go and get my CAMS motor racing licence years ago, but I was never a motor racer. I'd love to do that, but that's for another life. So yeah, mum used to play netball. We used to go and watch her. And we used to watch a lot of rugby league. So I thought the rules of netball were like the rules of rugby league. So I would go and watch her and go, tackle her, mum, tackle her. And, of course, that's eventually how I played. So at least now little girls get to watch netball players and can turn up to a netball court and actually know the rules.
So you started around high school time?
I started playing netball when I was eight, so I was early primary school. But I didn't really get into rep teams and stuff until I actually went into high school. And through that high school period, like I made the New South Wales Catholic Schoolgirls team. I grew up in Western Sydney. So I started to progress through, not realising that eventually it would take me somewhere that would eventually become a career.
Oh, you weren't planning on this to be, it was just a bit of fun, wasn't it?
It was a bit of fun. So when I was at school, I discovered that I was good at it. But then I didn't realise that there was something at the end of it. I just kept progressing and I kept doing it because I loved playing. Like if I made a rep team, I got to play 11 games on a Sunday, right? That is so exciting.
Yeah.
And then when I got to play into like New South Wales teams, we got to go away to other states and play. And so it was just always about the enjoyment and the passion. I never had a grand plan. And back then, netball wasn't professional and it's only become professional in the last couple of years.
Okay. And then in 1993, you became part of the Australian team, right? Mm-hmm. What was that like? Because that's obviously a massive jump to go from sort of New South Wales weekend playing to...
Yeah, well, I finished school in 1990 and then 3 years later, here I was in the Australian team.
Yeah, right.
This is
that
an
quick?
Amazing, yeah, amazing sort of thing to think about now. You know, it just, I was floating along and then I went to the AIS and in Canberra and I was on a 2-year scholarship there and that really tuned me into what I had to do to win. One of the things that we did when we were down there was we came up to Sydney and watched Australia and New Zealand in the final of the 1991 World Cup at the old Entertainment Centre. And there were 10,000 screaming fans there. Bob Hawke was there. Like it was a massive thing. It was the Prime Minister at the time and he was into it. And it really focused my mind on what was possible. And so I went back in the following year. I knuckled down and worked as hard as I could. So when I was selected 2 years later... Oh, actually, I was selected the following year into the Australian team and lots of people were surprised, but I wasn't because I had done the work and I had done the hard yards to get there.
Yeah, I guess that's what it's like for you and people don't really see that from far away. And then in 2004, so we're talking 11 years later,
yep.
This is when you became Australian captain.
Yes.
How does that feel like? You are representing everyone here, this whole country.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, it's like the look on your face says it all, like what that must be like. You know, it's interesting though. I became Australian captain and for me, this was it. This was a pinnacle. I was the captain of the Australian netball team, the team that represented the most people in Australia, like netball, the most popular team sport. I was the captain of the team.
Yeah.
And we were the best team in the world, right? Or actually, we were the second best at that time, but let's not let facts get in the way of a good story. And, you know, it was amazing. But what I didn't understand, that where I thought I had got to the pinnacle of my achievement, of my sporting career, but I was actually at the start in 2004 of a very long climb. So we lost the World Cup in 2003. Our coach had retired, our captain had retired. I became captain, we had a new coach. And we actually embarked on about an 18-month program of losing a lot of test matches, getting flogged by New Zealand. And then at the end of that little 18-month period, I tore the anterior cruciate ligament in my right knee. Yeah. So my dreams about, you know, representing Australia at the Melbourne Commonwealth Games, we don't get to play in the Olympics. So I wanted to play for Australia at the Commonwealth Games. It was a home games. I had started to think about how cool it would be to walk around in the opening ceremony and wave and, you know, all the important things. And suddenly I did my knee and that was taken away from me. And that was a huge black moment in my netball career.
So you didn't get to play in the Melbourne Games, and they finished second, didn't they? They didn't.
They did, so it's not my fault. It's Cheryl McMahon's fault. She was the captain for that.
Oh, that's very
I am not accepting responsibility. And Shaz is one of my best mates, so I can say that, knowing that she probably won't come after me.
How many tests did you play for Australia?
122 tests.
Is that some sort of record?
Yeah, it's the most test caps by any Australian player.
Right.
The world record's held by Irene van Dijk, who was, you know, my nemesis all the way through my career. And she played 100 and something caps for South Africa and then 100 and something caps for New Zealand. So she was a phenomenal athlete.
Yeah, wow. So then in 2007, after leading Australia to the World National Championships, you decided that was it.
Yep, it was all over.
It wasn't straight away, was it? It was a couple of weeks after?
It was 2 days after, but I had decided in the January before, but I hadn't told anyone.
Okay.
I kept it a secret because we had this period of getting pumped by New Zealand. I had my knee injury. And we'd come back and we just started to pick up games here and there and win here and there. But we knew it was going to be a big ask. We were playing the World Cup in New Zealand. Highly likely we'd meet them in the final. They were the world champions. They were the Commonwealth Games champions. We had to be an exceptionally close-knit team to take the game to them. I didn't feel that we could do that if I announced my retirement and everything became about me.
Yeah.
So don't get me wrong, I love everything being about me. And since I've retired, I have flogged my personal life mercilessly to the women's magazines. I have a great pool to show for it. But at the time, I really couldn't ask my teammates to focus on the task at hand if, on the other hand, I was making everything about me and my retirement. So I didn't tell a soul. I made the decision. Well, I did. I told my family, a couple of close friends and my agent, and we just kept it to ourselves until the end. And I'm so glad I did it because we were able to win and we were able to celebrate as a team. And it was just about our team. And it wasn't until a few days later when I announced it that it could then become about me.
We have to get into your old song now. What have you gone with?
I've gone with Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
I love Johnny. Love Johnny. And I loved Johnny Cash before it was trendy to love Johnny Cash, right? So he has always been a staple at our house growing up. Mum and Dad had all of his records and we listened to him so often. And I've chosen Sunday Morning Coming Down because it's just a song that I love. It's just so mellow and it's perfect for a Sunday morning.
Well, I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head. That didn't hurt. And the beer I had for breakfast wasn't bad, so I had one more for dessert. Then I fumbled in my closet, threw my clothes and found my cleanest dirty shirt. Then I washed my face and combed my hair and stumbled down the stairs to meet the day. I'd smoked my mind the night before with cigarettes and songs I'd been picking. But I lit my first and watched a small kid playing with a can that he was kicking. Then I walked across the street and caught the Sunday smell of someone's frying chicken. And Lord, it took me back to something that I lost somewhere, somehow along the way. On a Sunday morning sidewalk. I'm wishing, Lord, that I was stoned. 'Cause there's something in a Sunday that makes a body feel alone. And there's nothing sure to die in that's half as lonesome as the sound of the sleeping city sidewalk and Sunday morning coming down. In the park I saw a daddy with a laughing little girl that he was swinging. And I stopped beside a Sunday school and listened to the songs they were singing. Then I headed down the street and somewhere far away a lonely bell was ringing. And it echoed through the canyons like a disappearing dreams of yesterday. On a Sunday morning sidewalk, I'm wishing, Lord, that I was stoned. 'Cause there's something in a Sunday that makes a body feel alone. And there's nothing short of dying that's half as lonesome as the sound of the sleeping city sidewalk and Sunday morning coming down.
That'll be Johnny Cash there with Sunday Morning Coming Down. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Old New Borrow Blue, where I'm joined by Australian sporting hero and very selfless Liz Ellis.
Do you know what I've just realised? I think I was thinking the headphones didn't work, and it was because I had one on, but the plug that I plugged in was for the other one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway.
That's okay. You've done radio, but that doesn't matter.
I know, but you know what? I've hosted radio shows for years, and the whole panel business is a mystery to me.
Yeah, I'm just guessing. I have no idea what I'm doing right now. Now, you've done a bit of commentating since leaving the sport. Does it make you miss it more, or you're done?
No, I'm done. And I'm quite comfortably done, because for me, I was a sort of athlete that things didn't come naturally, right? I had good skills, but I was not a super fit individual, not overly muscly. So I had to train really hard. And so to get to the point where I could be competitive internationally, it took a huge amount of work. So when I was done, I was quite comfortable with the fact that I was done. And, you know, I get to still be heavily involved in the sport. I get to commentate week in, week out. You know, I'm there on Channel 9, and we're now live on the main channel on Saturday afternoons at 3 o'clock, Sundays at 1. So exciting for our sport. So I get now my adrenaline pump from being a part of that and being part of the process of bringing the stories of the sport to life for television and writing and that sort of thing. So I love it. And I get to travel and be involved with my sport, and I don't have to train, and I get to have a glass of wine at night, which is so nice.
Yeah, you get the fun part.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to get into your new song now, Liz.
Yes.
What have you gone with?
Okay, so I've gone Florence the Machine, and it's a song called Lungs. And when I was pregnant with my daughter, I listened, for some reason, I just felt like listening to Florence and the Machine all the time. Like, she was my binge, and I listened, and I loved Lungs because I knew that I was growing lungs inside of me with my little girl. So, and I just love Florence. I think she's just so good, and the beats in this song are great.
Like a train on a track.
Thank you kindly, Florence and the Machine. Now, for someone who's so big in Australian sport, you've gone on to write a book about infertility.
I know, it's funny, isn't it?
Can you tell us a little bit about your book, please?
If at first you don't conceive is the title. That was the first thing I thought of. And then when I thought of the title, I thought, oh, well, I'll have to write the book now to go with it because it's such a good title. But, you know, after I had my little girl, so she's, as I said, she's now six. I was 38 when I gave birth to her and we tried to have another baby pretty quickly, and I fell pregnant very quickly and I miscarried, and then 6 months later still nothing had happened, and we started really then to engage with the infertility industry. And it is an industry, there's no two ways about it. Now, it's an industry that helps a lot of people have children. It's also an industry that you can go down a rabbit hole and emerge 5 years later $50,000 poorer,
yeah,
and sometimes with no child to show for it. So, you know, it took us, we sort of had this treatment for four and a half years, and we tried everything. You know, we went to a naturopath and saw an acupuncturist and had fertility drugs and did IVF, and we fell pregnant three times. We had three miscarriages. The last miscarriage, we had seen the baby's heartbeat. So that was heartbreaking to go through that. Yeah. And we got to the point where we decided we weren't going to continue with treatment anymore. We felt that we had stopped focusing on our little girl, chasing a baby that didn't exist. My sister offered to do a donor round and to donate her eggs.
Mm-hmm.
Her and I thought that was really cool because our kids look like each other as it okay. is. And we sort of had to convince our husbands. But we did all the, you have to do genetic testing, you have to do counselling. We did all that. And while we were waiting to sync up our cycles, you know, she kept saying to me, when are you due? When's your period due? And I was like, well, I don't know. And she kept ringing me and she was like, you need to go and do a pregnancy test. And I did. And I was pregnant with Austin the old fashioned way. After 5 years, my body had done what it should have done. So we got to the end and, you know, I had my beautiful little boy who's now two. But I thought, I've got all of this information. I've got folders and folders of information, but I've also got this experience that there's so much that I know at the end of it all that I wish I knew at the start.
Yeah.
And I thought, why don't I put it into a book? All great ideas. And then I had to write the book. And it was really hard. It took me 8 months to write the manuscript. And then we went through six edits because we went through three literary edits and then three medical edits because I wanted to make sure that if I was selling a book that gives information about fertility and infertility and IVF and all that sort of stuff, it's got to be spot on. People have to be able to pick it up and rely on it, because the thing that struck me through this whole time, you do a Google search and yeah, there's lots of information out there, but how do you know what to trust? So the book was born, and it's been about 18 months all up with all the edits and everything, but I'm really proud of it.
And you've got actually quite a few stories in this book, haven't you?
I do.
Other people's stories.
Yeah.
And not always happy ending ones. There's obviously quite a few sad ones.
Yep.
How was that for you?
It was amazing, you know. Like lots of my friends and family had been through IVF, so I shamelessly stole their stories and told them that I was going to include it, and they're all cool with that.
Okay.
But I was missing a few bits and pieces, and I just put out a call on social for anyone who had been through fertility treatment. If you wanted to share your story with me, I'd love to hear it. And I got lots and lots of people come back to me, and I shot off emails with some questions and got lots of great answers. And some people, I thought, oh, I need to probably investigate your story a bit more. So I spoke to them over the phone. And for a lot of those people, it was the first time they'd ever shared their story with anyone outside, you know, their immediate relationship. And lots of times it was heartbreaking. But, you know, I would sit at my computer at night with my headphones in on the phone, tapping away as I listened to their story, and I'd be crying, I'd be bawling my eyes out. But, you know, lots of times it ends up being a love story about what people will do for their partner because they love them, what they would do to create a family. Sometimes it's a family that they dreamed of. Sometimes it's a different family, but they love the family that they've created. They love their children regardless of whether there's a biological link there or not.
Yeah.
So there's so many great stories. And there are stories of people who didn't get the baby that they so longed for and how they got through the process of dealing with that. And that's an important thing to acknowledge as well.
Absolutely. Look, I'm starting to get goosebumps. So we might go into your Borrowed song and then talk a little bit more about the book. What song have you gone
okay,
to Borrowed?
Borrowed, I've been a little bit creative here. The song is Everlong. It's the Foo Fighters. It's one of my favourite songs. But we borrowed it because we borrowed the title to name our farm. So when we moved to our farm 6 years ago, it was at a real moment in our life where things were changing and we got to somewhere where we were just deliriously happy. We had longed for so many years to move to the country and we were trying to think of a name for our farm. And my husband's brother has a farm out at Bathurst called Evergreen.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, that's a nice name. And then I was listening to this song one day and I'm like, Everlong. Like it's got a nice sort of continuity with Matthew's brother. It's my favourite song in the world. And so our property name now is Everlong. So we borrowed the name of it.
Brilliant. Here's Foo Fighters with Everlong. Foo Fighters there with Everlong. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Old New Borrow Blue, and my guest today is Liz Ellis, who's just written a new book, If At First You Don't Conceive. This book, did you learn a lot of new things, like that you were like, oh, I had no idea about this?
Yep, I learned so much, right? So you go through this infertility treatment, and you probably get given a lot of this information, but it simply doesn't sink in because you're trying to take it all in as you're trying to assess what the best option for you is, right? So what I hope is that people can pick up this book and read it before they go into too much treatment so that they can digest it and understand stuff when it gets told to them. But just little things like, so when you're at school, right, all the sex ed you have is around not falling pregnant. This is how you stop it happening. That's cool until you're in your 30s and you actually need to know the opposite. So I don't think we know anywhere near enough about our bodies and how they work, to the point where at one point I was writing the book and I thought, when I had my embryo transfer, you know, it gets zipped into your uterus, why doesn't it fall out of your uterus? Because everything that's drawn, when you see a uterus drawn, it's drawn like a balloon, right? Yeah. Why doesn't it fall out? So I rang my friend, the scientist, and I said to her, why doesn't it fall out? She goes, it's not a balloon. It's like a jam sandwich, right? And the walls of the uterus are the bread, and in between them is jam, and the embryo gets put into that, and it doesn't fall out. Right. And I was like, I did not know that.
I mean,
I've had a jam sandwich inside me all this time and I didn't know. So little things like that, I didn't know. I didn't know about, like, you know, there's things you can do like uterine scratching and that sort of stuff, which is a bit technical, but they're all options that we never really got around to exploring because I simply did not know. But I also didn't know about other causes of infertility. I didn't know, for example, anything about endometriosis or polycystic ovarian syndrome, all things which affect a lot of women. But I also didn't know much about male infertility.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you.
Yeah, which was just amazing, right? So fertility so often gets described as a woman's issue, right? It's a female thing. And, you know, lots of people are like, oh, with this book, you're really helping women. I want to help men too.
Yeah.
You know, I quite like men. I'm quite fond of them. but I want people to understand that when we talk about infertility, it's not a woman's issue. So of the people who are diagnosed, the couples that are diagnosed with infertility, 30% it's because of female factor infertility. And I very deliberately say factor and not fault. Infertility is no one's fault. It's a terrible thing to say when someone goes, oh, whose fault is it? It's no one's fault. 30% is female factor infertility. 30% is male factor infertility. And roughly, and these are fairly rough, but roughly 40% then in the middle is where the male is subfertile and the female is subfertile. So they both have issues that can contribute to taking longer to fall pregnant. You put those people together and it's almost impossible for it to happen. So, you know, we need to destigmatize male infertility. Both women and men get diagnosed with infertility, and for both of them, it's a real visceral hit to who you are and your belief about yourself. But women tend to be able to deal with it a little better because we've got close relationships that then you go and you talk about it. Men tend to not do that. And so they carry around this real injured sense of self, and we've got to get past that.
Yeah. When writing this book, is that sort of your plan? Do you want people to just talk about things more? Especially things like, I could be wrong here, but miscarriages, I feel, happen so early that people, you may not even know that person was pregnant.
Yes.
You know, and then they just will never tell you, but they keep that inside, and that must really hurt them. Do you want people now to just really start discussing it with friends and family? Is that the idea of the book?
Yeah, and having been through three miscarriages, I understand. And so 10 years ago, I lost my dad, right? You lose your dad and there are words for it. You can be very outward in your grief because people understand it. You've lost a parent, right? So you cry, you're sad, you're not into what you're doing. It takes months and months to get over it. Miscarriage is equally as devastating because it's a little life that was living inside you. But you don't tell people. We don't tell people, you know, because you didn't tell anyone you were pregnant. I can't tell anyone I miscarried. So I wish now that when I miscarried, I had have been far more open with it because I was at work doing things half pace. You know, I made mistakes in commentary and that sort of thing because my head wasn't in it. So, you know, I actually think it would be great to be able to talk about it. But that means developing a whole new language. What's the language that you use when you're grieving for somebody who never really existed other than as an embryo inside you? So that sort of stuff is where we've got to get to. And we will be able to work out what the language is once we start talking about it more. And, you know, I don't understand why we have this secrecy around, 12 weeks. And sure, that's when most miscarriages happen. But it's okay to talk about it. It's okay to admit that it happened. It's not a failure.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I really don't want to end on a sad note, so I want to ask you a question about you were at a dinner party while writing this book. Yes. Now, I've heard this story, and I want other people to hear it because I think it's absolutely brilliant. Someone...
Yeah, I'll tell you the story. And do you know what? What I hope you... Like, this book is full of information and advice, but it's full of funny little stories. And yes. I tried to make it funny because infertility can be so overwhelming and it can get really worthy. I want people to go, do you know what? There's some gallows humour in it. You can, there's things you can laugh at. You cannot think for years and years and years and be in a tunnel where all you think about is sperm and cervical mucus and your private parts and not have a giggle at it, right? So yeah. I just started writing the book and I was at a dinner party at a friend's place. And I didn't know too many people there. And someone said, oh, what do you do? And I told them and I said that I was writing this book. And a few drinks in, a guy came up and he sidled up to me and he goes, oh, I'm going to tell you this story, but you can't ever tell anyone that it was me that told you. I thought this would be good. So anyway, he was telling me that he and his wife had conceived through IVF. And I'm thinking, I don't understand the big deal about this story. And he goes, well, so before our first appointment, I was really worried about having to give a sperm sample. So I went and spoke to one of my mates who I knew had been through IVF. And he said, nah, it's great. You know, you go to this place, they put you in a room, there's a couch, there's some porn. Sometimes you get light beer and you can have a state sanctioned wank. It's the only time in your life where you're supposed to be having a wank, right? So I'm laughing like you at this point. So this bloke, he turns up and he's all nervous and they see the fertility specialist and they come out. And the nurse is talking to them and then she hands him this jar. And because he's so nervous and anxious about it, he hasn't listened to her. So she hands him this jar and she says, okay, you just go down there on your left and that's where you can go and do it. So he goes down on the left and walks in and he's so disappointed. There's no porn, there's no couch, there's no certainly no light beer. It's just a toilet and in a cubicle. And he was like, okay. But he goes, I didn't want to let the team down. So I huffed and I puffed and I did my job. And he was so happy, he was so relieved, got it all in the jar, went out handed it to the nurse, and she goes, I wanted a urine sample. So I cried with laughter. I said, oh, my God, that is going in my book. And he was, yeah, but changed the name to protect the guilty. So, you know, like you can't. You can't go through all this and not have something to laugh at. And absolutely. Do you know what? That is one of the funniest stories that people have picked up
brilliant.
On.
It is brilliant. I love it so much. Liz Ellis, thank you so much for coming in today.
My pleasure.
Your new book, If At First You Don't Conceive, is now available. If you are having children, want to have children, don't have children, whatever, go out and grab it because it's going to be such a great read. And now you have to take us out with your blues song.
Okay, so I've actually gone very literal on this and gone a blues song. And yeah. I live near Byron Bay and every year we go to Blues Fest and every year we love it. We have such a good time. And when I was pregnant with Austin, 2 weeks before I was due, Blues Fest was on. And I was trying to dance him out because he was enormous and I thought he's going to kill me if I have to give birth full term. So we went to Blues Fest and I found this band. They are awesome. And it just reminds me of dancing around with a massive belly. I did not go into labor, sadly, but I had a great night. And it's Nathaniel Rateley from the Night Sweats. And the name of the song is SOB.
Thank you very much.
I'm gonna need someone to help me. I'm gonna need somebody's hand. I'm gonna need someone to hold me down. I'm gonna need someone to care. I'm gonna rise and shake my body. I'll start pulling out my hair. I'm gonna cover myself with the ashes of you, and nobody's gonna give a damn. Son of a bitch, give me a drink. One other night, but this can't be me. Son of a bitch, if I can't get clean, I'm gonna drink my life away. For 17 years I've been going limber. 17 more will bury me. And somebody please just tie me down.
Somebody give me a goddamn drink. Son of a bitch! Give me a drink. One more night. This can't be me. Son of a bitch! If I can't get clean, I'm gonna drink my life away. Yeah, yeah. My heart is breaking, hands are shaking, bugs are crawling all over me. My heart is breaking, hands are shaking, bugs are crawling all over me. My heart is breaking, hands are shaking, bugs are crawling all over me. My heart is aching, hands are shaking, bugs are crawling all over me. Son of a bitch! Give me a